Now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades, this is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
So, ladies and gentlemen, yesterday or last night around 6 p.m., we covered live, we simulcast CNN's town hall meeting on the horrific shooting in Florida that featured both senators from Florida, Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson, as well as the sheriff from Broward County, who said that he is going to put police officers with long rifles in the schools in order to protect them. And a member of the NRA, a spokesperson of the NRA, Dana Loesch, as well as a Democratic congressman. It was a pretty heated conversation. And the president, meanwhile, was speaking with the survivors and family members of those who lost their lives in school shootings going back to Aurora, Colorado, Columbine, through the incident in Florida. But meanwhile, while that was going on, here's what else what was going on. A 13-year-old in Pennsylvania was arrested and charged with threatening to shoot up his school, Wendover Middle School in Pennsylvania. A 27-year-old man was arrested in Norco with a loaded AR-15, two loads of handguns, and large amounts of ammunition in his bedroom, threatening to shoot up a college. In Long Beach, two separate teenagers, a 15-year-old and 16-year-old, were arrested on suspicion of making criminal threats against their schools, Millikan High School for the 15-year-old, Wilson High School for the 16-year-old. And these were unrelated. So this was going on separately. And then Marino Chavez, alertly, as a deputy on the campus of El Camino High School in Whittier, overheard a student talking about shooting up his school. They brought him into the principal's office. They called the police. The sheriff's department, L.A. County Sheriff's Department, went, searched his home, two semi-automatic AR-15s, two handguns, and 90 high-capacity magazines. Joining us to talk about this is the sheriff of L.A. County, Jim McDonald. Good morning, Sheriff.
Good morning, Doug. Thank you for having me on.
Fortunately, we're talking to you about this interdiction and not a horrific tragedy, or actually atrocity, which is the word I prefer to use. A tragedy is a car accident. These things are atrocities. And fortunately, Mr. Chavez was great at his job.
Yeah. Now, we're very fortunate that worked out the way it did, that Mr. Chavez took the appropriate action. He's got 27 years of experience working school campuses. So we were very, very lucky that he was the one who did the overhear, took the right steps. The deputies followed up on it, and then they did a rollback search warrant. And as you mentioned, we found what we did. But, you know, very, very troubling to see not only this case, but so many others like it, fed by social media, I think, in large part.
Do you think that's a – I mean, everybody is – hopefully everybody is doing some introspection as to why. And we've been asking the big question, which I think is the big question. Why is America producing so many young people who are acting out in this fashion or killing themselves? Because we have a huge spike in young people taking their own lives, including one young woman in Chicago who killed herself at the age of 10. There's just some sickness that's unleashed in society. And I agree with you. I think the social media phenomenon is definitely a contributing factor.
Yeah, you know, I think when you look across the country and you see the types of activities that you mentioned there, it's a breakdown in basic respect across the country and producing a feeling of hopelessness in many, particularly those who are affected with, you know, mental health issues. And there's not the systems in place. And really what it comes down to in a large percentage of these cases is, you know, a parent who is on top of what's happening, knows who their child is dealing with on social media, and has a pulse on, you know, does my kid need help? And if so, how do I get it for them?
What should parents do? Let me back up for a second. The same time that the shooting took place in Florida, a grandmother up in Oregon stumbled on her grandson's diary and then searched his bedroom and found a weapon stashed in a guitar case, and she called the police, and that may very well have saved lives. She did, obviously, the right thing as well. But in general, what should parents be doing?
You know, I think the big thing is just having a sense of awareness. Know what the kid is involved in, who their friends are, if there's changes in behavior over time, if their kids are using drugs or alcohol, and then just, like I said, a sense of awareness too, as far as what's their mental state? Do they need help? Are they coping well with the pressures that kids are under today? I don't think it's ever been more difficult or complex to be a young person than it is today. And so they need help. They need mentoring. And, you know, we've got parents who are, you know, legitimately busy working two jobs and not able to spend the time that they maybe would like to be able to spend with their kids. But we've got to be able to work together to create youth programs, you know, for kids, so they have a place to go after school. They have an adult role model. They have somebody who's interested in what they're doing, encourages them, you know, in their schoolwork and sports and activities. The things that growing up we often took for granted, many of the kids today don't have those things available to them.
We're talking with L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald. Sheriff, what can you tell us about this particular incident at El Camino High School? Is it your belief? Is it too early to tell? Do you believe that this was an actual plot in the making?
You know, it is. It's from what I know, it's too early to be able to say definitively that this was going to happen. I think that all of the indicators were there that there was the at least the potential motivation for the individual to act based on his comments. And certainly he had the capacity to be able to carry out those threats with the weapons that we seized and his access to the weapons. That's another thing when you look at young people, we're talking nationally about how old should you be able to buy a firearm. If the weapons are in the home, accessible to anybody in that location, it doesn't matter, you know, what we do for laws. We need to be able to protect our young people by securing firearms appropriately.
All right. I hate to drag you into a political issue, but I just don't know how we can avoid talking about guns themselves. That we used to have an assault weapons ban in this country. And I got to be honest with you, I'm a pro Second Amendment guy. I think that if you're not a criminal and you don't have any history of mental illness, you have every right to have weapons for personal defense or for sport or because you just like having them. But with that said, we used to have an assault weapons ban in this country, and I just don't remember people walking around saying, I'm oppressed. My government is oppressing me.
No, exactly. I think it all comes down to what's reasonable. What did our forefathers intend when they put, you know, that Second Amendment in place? And I don't know that they could have had, you know, the vision to see what technology would do. Where is the limit? Where do we draw the line? And that's not something that I can answer today. It's something that we need to have a very strong conversation across our nation about, you know, what's reasonable. How do we protect the public that we're elected to do in a way that doesn't hamper their rights unnecessarily? And that's a tough question.
It is a tough question because it becomes a very emotional issue. And I know at some fundamental level, you know, I was having this conversation with my wife at home. This country was founded, what we call the American Revolution was in fact a civil war when it started. And it's in the DNA of Americans that when we were fighting at Bunker Hill and at the Boston Massacre and those early battles, Lexington and Concord, it was British citizens firing on British soldiers who they felt were oppressing them. And the fact that Americans were armed gave them the ability to win their independence. And then the whole independence movement grew out of that. But I personally feel, and then there's the Civil War. And let's not forget, there are many people, many millions of people in the South, and people rarely talk about this as a cultural marker. But there are many millions of people in the South who feel like when the war of Northern aggression came into the South, that they were fighting an oppressive government, and the fact that they were armed enabled them to defend their homeland. Meanwhile, I personally believe if it comes to the point in modern America where we have to fight our own government, who are we fighting? We're fighting our own sons and daughters. And if that's the case, we've already lost the country. I mean, you know, people can disagree on this issue, but I don't think that doing the same thing we've been doing is an option. I just don't. I just something's gone wrong here and we have to do better than what we're doing.
I agree. And when you look at, you know, the outrage by the young people as a result of this shooting in particular, enough is enough. It's heartening to see that the next generation is taken a position that we're not going to go along with the status quo, that we're looking for answers. I just hope that the answers that we come up with are well thought through, that they're nuanced enough to be able to not just have a knee-jerk reaction to, you know, to try and fix things quickly, but to have a thoughtful one that will have the intended outcomes.
The specific incident in Florida, there's a lot of questions being asked, and appropriately so, about the FBI, about local law enforcement, et cetera, having missed signs. What does the L.A. County Sheriff's Department learn from this? I assume that an incident this high profile, your staff is going to take a look at the protocols that were followed or not followed and learn from it.
No, absolutely. Every time there's a critical incident anywhere in the nation, we study it and we share what we get with other agencies to try and be better, as a result of that experience. But in L.A. County, we have a number of systems in place. We have school resource deputies spread throughout the LASD jurisdiction. We have way too few of those people. I'd love to be able to, you know, have many, many more, because they not only are in a position to be able to be helpful in an act of violence and stopping it quickly, but also in helping be a role model, be a mentor for many of the kids. The benefits from that are twofold, I think, in that regard. In our community colleges, which we provide public safety for, we have a higher education assessment team that looks at threats, that looks at people who are at risk. We had received 141 referrals last year, and 13 of those turned into open cases. So far this year, we have 6 open cases there. We take those very seriously, and we work with the Department of Mental Health. We have the MET teams across the county, and that's something I would love to be able to expand dramatically from where we are, because the success rate there, a MET team is a deputy paired up with a mental health professional, a mental health clinician, and they roll out on a call when somebody's having a mental health crisis, and they deal with them differently. And the results are they don't end up going to jail. In 95% of the cases, they end up getting treatment. And we don't have that kind of a success rate really in anything else we do. So to be able to take what's a great model and to be able to expand that, and hopefully if we're able to expand it enough, we could also have the MET teams deal with some of the issues we see with young people in school environments that are a potential danger to themselves or others.
The Sheriff Israel in Broward County yesterday announced that he's going to have police officers with long guns stationed at schools in Broward County. And I know that this is very controversial for a lot of people. I personally believe that putting signs up to say this is a gun-free zone is about as effective as thoughts and prayers. It might be a nice sentiment, but it doesn't actually protect a kid against a nut who's coming in and opening fire. I also, by the way, do not support arming teachers. I think teachers got their hands full without having to worry about drawing on getting a bead on somebody in a classroom full of kids. But having somebody on the campus who has the power to stop somebody at this point, it's insane we're not doing that.
Yeah, that's the school resource deputy program in a nutshell, where we have a police officer, a deputy sheriff on the campus. And they perform a multitude of functions, not only safety by their presence alone, but also the ability to be able to respond quickly to an incident when it occurs. I think it's a great model. But as I mentioned, we have, a relative handful for the number of schools throughout L.A. County.
Well, that's something that we should be taking a serious look at. And like today, Sheriff, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it. And we'll obviously follow the story.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, that's Sheriff Jim McDonald, L.A. County. We want to circle back to the hashtag MeToo movement and the allegations that Sacramento has had its own Boys Town operation going for many, many years. And State Senator Tony Mendoza, this coming, by the way, the day after a top executive at the Ford Motor Company was ousted, and the NBA is looking into the behavior at the Dallas Mavericks organization with Mark Cuban. But State Senator Tony Mendoza is really feeling the heat now, refuses to resign. To talk to us about this is the investigative journalist and author of California's War Against Donald Trump, Katie Grimes. Katie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Doug and Leanne. Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on. So apparently more and more allegations coming out against Tony Mendoza.
Yes, the investigation that, or I should say the independent investigation that's being done by a law firm hired by the Senate found that there have been at least six women who have claims against him for sexual harassment or abuse. And, yeah, you're right. He is pretty much refusing to leave and instead turned around and sued the Senate for, he claims, illegally suspending him.
The president, a pro tem of the Senate, Kevin DeLeon, of course, is wrestling with this one. At the same time, he's running a Don Quixote-like campaign against Dianne Feinstein to oust her from the United States Senate. But meanwhile, this is a problem, and this is where, you know, this is why people hate politics, because what the right thing to do is running right into the fact that the Democrats in Sacramento are afraid that they're going to lose their supermajority if they keep kicking these grabby-ass politicians and throw them out of office.
You're exactly right, and that's all they care about. The sexual harassment laws, frankly, which they pass and enforce on the rest of us, require that, you know, as soon as a victim comes forward and alleges sexual harassment, that the management's responsibility is to separate the victim, protect him or her, and find another role kind of immediately while the investigation goes on for the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator. That's not happening. Nobody gives a hoot about the victims in the state capitol, and there are many. In the past, what they've done is fired them and made them sign some sort of an agreement, maybe paid them off, maybe not, that they'll never, ever come back to work again in the Capitol. And they've destroyed their reputations. So we've got kind of a two-tier system here, one for the, you know, the elite politicians, the grabby ones, as you call them, and another for the staff and the rest of us.
We're talking with Katie Grimes, author of California's War Against Donald Trump, Who Wins, Who Loses. Katie, we've been following with a certain degree of amusement the tale of Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, who apparently was accused of playing drunken spin the bottle in her office. And she's saying now that this is just a political smear designed to discredit her record. She drunk when she said that? Because who in the world would go through the effort to concoct these kinds of stories and this many stories to smear someone that no one ever heard of?
Yeah, you got it. It's from the You Can't Make This Stuff Up file. And the stories about her have been floating around for years. I mean, the first that I heard of weirdness surrounding Christina Garcia was in about 2014 when I heard really awful tales about how she used to make her staff go clean up her apartment, which apparently was a pigsty that, you know, looked like it belonged on the Tent City Street. There's just strangeness. She's required, frankly, employees to sit around and drink with her in the middle of the day. It's one of the allegations. And boy, that's a huge violation of, you know, workplace protocol. And then also, apparently, while she's juiced up, she's made advances to certain men and grabbed at them. So, yeah, it's pretty bizarre. If I was going to politically smear someone, I'd be a little more, let's just say I would be more creative than that.
You know, one of the things that, with all of this, what goes on in Washington, it doesn't amaze me. It is just amazing at how many really inferior people we have in elective office. I mean, people who just, yep. You wouldn't trust them to run a shift at a Wendy's.
Oh, you're right. Unfortunately, also, they're not just inferior, you know, morally, ethically. They are narcissists, which is why you see them. It's part of why they gravitate to politics. And, Doug, frankly, a lot of them, I think, were losers in their private sector jobs, if they ever held one. Or just kind of losers in private life. But they've got this narcissism component that, wants them in power. And that's why I think we're seeing, I mean, Tony Mendoza is absolutely desperate. He's got nothing to go to when he's ousted from the Capitol. And so he's trying absolutely everything to keep his job.
Yeah, that's the problem with these people is that it goes from public service to self-service. And one of the eternal lessons of George Washington is his greatness comes from giving up power. At the end of the American Revolution, after the Newburgh uprising, when his unpaid officers, for 8 years, they had been stiffed by a Continental Congress that had no money to pay them. And they were literally planning on marching on Philadelphia and taking over the country in a military coup d'etat. And Washington put that down and then immediately raced to Philadelphia and resigned his commission as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army and returned to being a private farmer. And when King George III heard about this, he said, well, if this is true, he will be remembered as the greatest man who ever lived. Because in all of history, there had never been a man on horseback at the end of a revolution who didn't then take over and run the place. And he did it a second time when he announced he would not run for re-election after his second term and he felt his power slipping. He felt in order to prove that this experiment of ours, we had to have the peaceful transfer of power after an election. That's twice that he gave up power and returned to being a private citizen. And these guys can't think that way. They just bounce from office to 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 office. And they think
career politicians
that they're irreplaceable. And you look at guys like David Shulkin of the Veterans Affairs Inspector General, the secretary, excuse me, of the VA. And you look at Tom Price in the cabinet, flying on chartered aircraft, taking military jets, bringing their wives with them over to Europe as part of their security detail. They live like Caligula.
Yeah, we have that. Yeah, exactly. How about Nancy Pelosi, who had a special runway and hangar built for her at the San Francisco airport? And she was using military
jets
back and forth.
Yes. It's grotesque.
It is grotesque. And these people constantly, especially in the California legislature, we see them get caught all the time abusing the powers of their offices, whether it's, you know, the state provided car or the gas card or, you know, requiring their staff to shuttle them around town. I mean, it's just ridiculous how they think that they are something.
Life looks very different from the back of the town car. But now it's, of course, the back of the SUV with tinted windows than it does when you're in the front. You're stuck in gridlock. All right, listen, Katie, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it. Katie Grimes. We told you yesterday that Polly Perrette, longtime star of NCIS, who was attacked, a terrifying attack in November of 2015 by a transient, a bum named David Merck, who tried to strangle her. And that guy is back out of a state psychiatric institution and back on the streets. To talk to us about this right now is our pal from Fox 11, Phil Schumann. Phil, you've been following up on this.
Doug, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you coming on. So do we know where David Merck is now?
Well, he's usually at Franklin and Argyle in Hollywood, lives under the overpass there. And when he got out, which apparently was last week, some of the neighbors in the neighborhood association there spotted him, took his picture, put out a warning on Facebook and other social media posts, and just to be careful of this guy, that he's back out. He served apparently at least a couple of years in the state psychiatric facility, and then he was released, and now he's back out on the street.
Now, this this case is like the poster child for what's gone wrong with our system.
Absolutely.
Because, I don't understand how David Merck wasn't charged with attempted murder and why he's out. Of course, we suspect it's Prop 57, 47, AB 109, or just the fact that he was classified as a psychiatric patient rather than a criminal. So you got that issue. But then, you know, the LAPD and hospitals in L.A., they have been accused and penalized for, quote-unquote, patient dumping or, you know, dropping homeless people in downtown L.A. But if you're... If you're picked up as a homeless person, where exactly are the police supposed to release you?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, there's options. I mean, it ranges from the street to a shelter if there's space. If you're released from a prison, you're essentially in a lot of times you're literally given a bus ticket or a voucher. And they drop you off at the bus station and you're on your own. I mean, you're pointing out a huge problem with the system, a glaring hole. I mean, this to me is the story of our time, the homeless crisis, the mentally ill crisis, the drug user crisis on the streets. I mean, this is one of the worst examples because this guy is violent and she is afraid to leave her house. I mean, she lives in the Hollywood Hills. She was very public about it when it happened, especially on social media, but you know, she's afraid this guy's going to kill someone. You talk to the police, they say, we know he's released. It's not a crime to be homeless. We can't preemptively arrest somebody. We can't act, essentially, until he commits another crime, which, you know, technically and legally makes sense, but, of course, is incredibly frustrating.
We're talking with Phil Schumann, reporter at Fox 11, and you can follow him on Twitter at Fox Phil. So here we are. Did anybody ever explain why he was not charged with attempted murder?
You know, those kinds of details are a little difficult to get. I mean, if you talk to the district attorney's office, they won't go into it. I mean, he was charged with felony criminal threats and imprisonment by violence, which are, you know, crimes that I'm not even that familiar with those actual charges. And then the circumstances of his release are unclear also. There's so much emphasis on privacy laws, which are there for good reason to protect the rights of patients, that for the news media to get details on something like this, unless the person themselves volunteers, a lot of times it's tough to get. We're still trying to get some answers from the DA and from the state as to exactly how this guy, and you know, what it was his original sentence, and then how he ended up back out on the street relatively quickly.
Yeah. Well, again, I just don't understand how you can try to strangle somebody, especially somebody as prominent as Paulie Perrette, in broad daylight, and you're not charged with attempted murder. I just, you know, it's a head scratcher, because by not charging with attempted murder, we virtually guarantee that this person is going to be back out on the street. And, you know, in talking to all the healthcare professionals about the shootings, the mass shootings,
right,
that a better predictor of who's going to end up as a shooter is a history of violence, not necessarily collecting weapons themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you have somebody who's collecting weapons and has been acting out either at home or, you know, especially when you see the pattern of being violent towards animals, you know, cruelty to animals,
right,
as a precursor to mass murderers very frequently. It's almost a textbook indicator. Well, we've got a person here, David Merck, who has a history of serious violence on the streets. And this isn't, you know, the person who may be a sad, you know, tragic case of somebody living on the street. This is a person who's dangerous.
Right. And I spoke to the detectives in Hollywood, and they're, you know, ideally you would say, okay, we know who this guy is. We know where he spends most of his time. We're going to keep an eye on him. First of all, they don't have people to do that. Second of all, they told me they got 100 guys like him. Not 100 guys who have gone to prison for attacking somebody, but 100 people, you know, they're talking in general terms, with the potential for violence. I mean, you know, this happens, you know, the risk is what's new now, relatively new. I mean, we've dealt with the homeless problem. I know you talk about it a lot. We've covered it a lot. But what's changed now is the nature of the people out there. It's dangerous to be out where homeless people are. It used to be, you know, people panhandling, asking for money. You know, you could talk with them, hey, can we get you some help, and refer them to an agency. Now, even for us in the news media, we got to be extremely careful. And the members of the public, I mean, we've covered it. Remember the woman in Hollywood was murdered a year or so ago. There was an attack a couple of weeks ago in broad daylight. Didn't get much coverage. A homeless person, like, body slammed a person that was just crossing the street. So what's the answer? I don't know.
Well, nobody really has an answer to this, but one of the I believe this emphatically, that we're not serving anybody by romanticizing or cutting the crust off the bread of homelessness. You know,
no.
You know, Moscow on the Hudson might have been a charming movie with Robin Williams, but this notion that, and it's been repeated endlessly, that we are all, quote unquote, one paycheck away. And it's just not true, because the vast majority of people, if they fell on hard times, they haven't alienated the entire social safety net of their lives. They haven't alienated all of their friends and family to the point where there's nobody willing to give them, you know, three hots and a cot until they get back on their feet. But that's what happens. You know, we saw this in the tragic, horrific case of down in Terry, why am I blanking on his name now, who was beaten to death, the Kelly Thomas.
When
Kelly Thomas
in Orange County
was on the streets because his family they tried to keep him in the house, and he would wander out, or he would have incidents that made it scary. And that's what happens oftentimes, is that people, either because of drug addiction or alcoholism or mental illness, it's not safe to keep them in the house anymore, or you can't. They literally, unless you're going to chain them to the radiator, they walk out of the house and they're gone for sometimes weeks, months, and even years at a time.
I mean, here's the thing. There is no place to put these people. We passed H. We passed triple H. Long-term money to build housing. Okay, we're going to put a house in a halfway house for homeless people, recovering addicts in your neighborhood. It's not going to happen. They're going to build, 200 supportive housing units in downtown Los Angeles. 200, great. There was Steve Lopez, who should be winning Pulitzer Prizes for his coverage of this issue, wrote yesterday in the LA Times about a plan to build on the VA campus. Each unit cost $600,000. The politicians have 100% failed us. This Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, which is a joint city-county agency, was created 20 years ago. Where are they, and what do they do? If I was a city council person, I would have a mobile office. I would put it in my district. Any place with a homeless encampment, I would make that my office for a week until every one of those people had services. This judge in Orange County is a hero, in my view, this federal judge. He said, I'm not listening to all your excuses. I'm going down there, and I'm going to make sure these people have help. Now, granted, it's temporary. They're living in a motel until something more permanent could be worked out. But at least he's an example of someone cutting through the red tape and getting something done. And nobody in Los Angeles is doing that, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. And, one of the fascinating aspects of that, because we played the sound of this yesterday, James Rojas was down there covering that story, that the homeless who were living in the Santa Ana Riverbed became NIMBYs. They became possessive of their place, and they were upset that other homeless people were coming in and getting the vouchers who didn't live in the riverbed.
Cutting in line.
I mean, so this issue, man, it's peeling an onion.
No, it's the biggest. I mean, it impacts everybody.
Yep.
You saw the story we did last week in Koreatown in a trash-filled alley right behind a middle school where kids are walking through human waste, syringes. It's been cleaned up 20 times. It gets back to the disaster that, 2018 Los Angeles, there's $1 billion developments in downtown Los Angeles, a multi-billion-dollar development in Inglewood with a stadium. There's not money and there's not the political will to take care of this crisis. It's just shocking to us.
This is where the civil libertarians are going to hate this, but until we criminalize vagrancy and we can remove people forcibly from the streets and have some place to put them, this is never going to go away. Phil, thanks so much for being with us.
Right,
always appreciate it. Fox 11 TV, Fox at Fox Phil on Twitter. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We have to circle back to a story that we brought you a couple weeks ago, courtesy of the Los Angeles Times, their sensational page one expose on the DROP program, the Deferred Retirement Option Plan for LAPD and LAFD veterans. 50 plus with 25 years or more experience on the job allows them to for 5 years to continue to collect their full salaries and full pensions concurrently. But what we learned was that many of them then go out on workers' comp and don't even show up for work, some for as long as 3 years at a time. In a follow-up piece in Sunday's LA Times, Jack Dolan and staff uncovered the one-day rule. And he's with us now to talk about it, investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to the show, Jack Dolan. Good morning, Mr. Dolan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. And so what is the one-day rule?
Well, back in 2008, after this DROP program had been around for about 5 years, there were rumors circulating all across City Hall about, guys going into this program, getting their pension and their salary, maybe a guy who makes $150 a year is now making $300, and then going out for years with a bad back or a sore knee. and not even showing up, you know, to give his veteran leadership. So the city hall, city leaders decided they'd have to fix this. So they instituted what we call the one-day rule, which means in order to be in the program, you have to be on active duty. But the city administrative code contains what can only be described as the biggest loophole I've ever seen. It says you only have to be on active duty for one day. So we found example after example of people who had been out with, you know, bad knees, like a guy who'd hurt his knee standing up from his desk, had been out for a year, comes back for, I think it was three shifts, and then goes out again, you know, for long injury leaves, for cumulative trauma to his hips, comes back to work about a year later, maybe 2 years later, and suffers a back injury picking up some paper to load into a photocopier, and is out for another year. And these are not extreme examples. I mean, this is over and over again what's going on.
Now, the question that I think everybody has is why was it that the city council and our various mayors only heard rumors of this? Where was the accounting? Where was the audit of this program? Why were the people who are charged with the fiduciary obligation to look out for the taxpayers' money in a city where the former mayor, Richard Reardon, is writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal saying it has to go into bankruptcy to escape a pension debt that they can't pay. This is not a secret. And yet nobody appeared to be looking at the books on what this program was costing anybody.
No, nobody did. I mean, we searched high and wide for any kinds of reports that would have detailed what we eventually found. So we went in, we got 10 years of very, very detailed city payroll data and a list of all the people who'd been in the drop. It wasn't, you know, I mean, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't the hardest thing we've ever done. And we just compared the two databases, and we were shocked by, I mean, half the people who go into this drop program then go out on workers' comp claims. The average length of their absence is 10 months. So that's 10 months getting double pay. But I mean, we found hundreds of people who were out for more than a year. And again, these are guys who are in their 50s. These aren't guys who were shot in the line of duty or had a building collapse on them. These are guys with bad backs and sore knees. And I mean, they may very legitimately have bad backs and sore knees. The question is, should you be paying them double while they, you know, go through physical therapy?
We're talking with Jack Dolan, investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. You can follow on Twitter at Jack Dolan, L-A-T. I want to use one sample of this past Sunday's column. Daniel McElhenney worked on fireboats in the port of Los Angeles and had filed multiple claims for back and knee injuries he suffered stepping off and on the vessels. After joining the program, he worked...
That was a problem for him during his career. He struggled with that aspect of the job.
And after joining the program, he worked four more shifts. Okay, again, he showed up for work 4 days is what we're talking about, four shifts. Then underwent back surgery for an old work injury he had aggravated 2 years earlier, lifting a suitcase at the end of an Alaskan cruise. And he took 14 months off to recover, according to payroll records. And then after he returned to work, he hurt his knee again, stepping off a boat, and missed another 5 months. His injuries kept him from working for the city while in drop, but it did not keep him from working part-time as a longshoreman at L.A. Harbor, which is one of the best-paying jobs in all of contractdom. Working as a longshoreman is like finding a lottery ticket.
It is. So is working for the fire department, by the way.
So, you know, it's hard to say, and I'm certainly not, I don't want to use the criminal fraud word. Oh, I just did. But I don't want to use that word because what we did was we legalized, we created a system by which people could do this legally, essentially, unless there's some proof that all of these injuries were faked. And I'm not alleging that. He may, in fact, have knee problems and back problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we incentivized somebody who might play through. Because I'll tell you right now, Jack, in many, many, many companies in America, if you don't show up for work, you don't get paid. There's a lot of people who have no sick days, and I'm not advocating
my company.
Right. and this one for our part-time employees here, it's the same thing. If you miss a shift, you're not getting paid. And I'm not arguing that that's good for America, because what it does is it means people come to work when they've got the flu and then everybody gets sick. I mean, there's a lot of short-sightedness to that policy, in my opinion. But if you take that as one extreme, then you've got this as another extreme where we've made it, we've set up a system by which people cannot show up for years and become essentially wealthy.
And keep in mind, it's the people who don't have any kind of retirement plan, who have to show up whether they're sick or not. They're the people who are paying the taxes for the other people to not show up for years and make $300,000.
And I want to – then this is something else, and I don't know that the police and the fire understand this. But in this day and age where we got a story in here. We're going to do the story in just a few minutes. A couple of LAPD officers were bitten in Tarzana dealing with some monster, you know, some maniac that they had to go and deal with. The job is physical. The job includes chasing kids down an alley and hopping fences. And we know what all the downside is and what all the difficulty is. But the whole job is 100 times harder when you don't have the support of the community that you serve. And when the cops and the firefighters are perceived as milking the system, that's a form of corruption. Even if it's legal, even if we created a system that legalized it, it erodes faith in the badge and in public service. And I'm telling you, it is so destructive to the reputation of cops and firefighters that, you know, maybe they say, what do I care? I'm getting mine. But, you know, it defeats the whole purpose of having veteran cops and firefighters to mentor and pass along their collective institutional knowledge to the next generation. If the next generation comes in and inherits bad blood in the community because the taxpayers feel like they were ripped off by the last guys.
And that was, I mean, the stated purpose of this program was to keep these veterans in the firehouses, in the police precincts, so that they could, you know, mentor the new guys. But it really does defeat the stated purpose of the program if half of those people are going off on these long extended leaves at twice the pay, because then you don't even get what you're paying for.
Now, folks, this has cost us $1.6 billion in extra pension payments since 2002. $1.6 billion. Now, I know that we've gotten numb to numbers, because you hear all the numbers out of Washington where it sounds like Carl Sagan, you know, with astronomer numbers. But $1.6 billion from just this program is an astonishing amount of money that the city of Los Angeles is on the hook for. And that's why they're constantly coming back and looking for tax hikes in every form. And if not tax hikes, then their fees, which are taxes, because try not paying them and see what happens to you. There's real world consequences for this. The roads aren't fixed. The sidewalks aren't fixed. There's all kinds of problems that are just, you know, government 101 stuff that's being ignored. Trees weren't being trimmed, et cetera, that contributed to the sidewalks being crumbled. While we've got a mushrooming pension obligation that has to be fixed. And if not, we're going to end up like San Bernardino or Stockton or any of the Central Falls, Rhode Island, any of the municipalities around the country that have actually gone into BK. And then you're going to see a storm of anger when cops and firefighters find out that their pensions that they were promised and have been collecting are now in the hands of a bankruptcy court, because a state can't declare bankruptcy, but a municipality can.
That's right. And the consequences, by the way, the political leaders who approved this won't talk about it. We spent more than a week trying to get Antonio Villaraigosa, who signed the one-day rule when he was mayor, to respond to questions about it. He just would not. Same with Eric Garcetti, who was the city council president when the thing was passed. He got it through the city council meeting in 17 seconds without debate. We have a
17 seconds without debate. Let's yep. just fly this baby through. But by the way, there was a fantastic quote, not from Eric Garcetti, but from an unnamed Eric Garcetti spokesperson after Mitch Englander held his public hearings on this. And that was predictable. Dennis Zine used to be the go-to guy for the city council when there was a problem with the police because, as a reserve officer, they figured he could manage it and give a certain amount of political cover. And now Mitch Englander plays that role because he's a police reserve officer. So he'll be the right guy to manage this. So he has a public hearing where he was shocked to discover gambling in Casablanca, along with Paul Kerkorian and everybody else on the city council. Just shocked. Even though they get financial reports, they get the spreadsheets, they get the budgets, they're the people who could see the numbers if they bothered to look at them. And my guess is they did, and they just ignored it. But nonetheless, the quote of note was from an unnamed Eric Garcetti spokesperson who said, quote, Mitch Englander is asking the right questions. Oh, boy, that's leadership. That's leadership from the top. An unnamed spokesperson saying, well, Mitch Englander seems to have a handle on it. He's asking the right questions, and those questions should be answered. And now I'll go back to hiding. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing. It's amazing because this is a city. We could put hundreds of thousands of people in the street to talk about, you know, the issue du jour and what's going on in Washington. And rightly so. I mean, people should obviously be paying attention to what goes on in Washington. But the fact that right here in our front yard, this kind of absolute, at minimum, fiscal recklessness is going on and potential outright criminal fraud is going on and codified and institutionalized by our elected officials. And they're pretending like they had nothing to do with it. They're pretending like somehow this fell on us from outer space. It's just Jack, I got to tell you, this is newspaper journalism at its best. And I congratulate you again and everybody working with you on this story at the L.A. Times. It's such an important story that we'll keep you keep writing it. We'll keep talking to you about it and we'll keep pushing it out there because this cannot stand. This is unsustainable.
Thank you. There's more to come.
All right. Thank you, Jack Dolan, Los Angeles. It's amazing, folks.
More.
It really is. And if you want to do a real public service here, use your social media platforms. Go to Los Angeles Times and find the stories by Jack Dolan on the Drop program. It's easy to find. There's now two major pieces. And share them as broadly as possible. We have them linked on our Facebook page. Go grab these stories and send them around to your friends. And by all means, call your member of the city council and say, this is not acceptable. And I will remember this on election day because they did this. These are not obscure people. A lot of the people that signed off on this, every member of the city council, everybody in citywide elective office, this is Mike Fuhrer, this is Ron Galperin, the city controller, everybody bears responsibility for this story. The link is on Facebook, so you can go find it on our Facebook page, McIntyre in the Morning, and you can certainly get it at latimes.com. Ladies and gentlemen, we told you that the actress Pauly Parrott of NCIS is living in fear because that maniac, the homeless maniac, who a transient named David Merck, who attacked her, has been released from a state psychiatric institution, is back on the streets, and she's going to have to be looking over her shoulder, and that's just one of the many issues that come in the wake of this epidemic of homelessness that we're dealing with in Southern California. It's a national problem, but it's particularly horrible here, with the homeless capital of the country. And one of the ground zero points is the Santa Ana River bed. As you know, ever since a couple of bicyclists went riding through there with their GoPro cameras and the world saw this dystopian, this Blade Runner vision of hopelessness, then the heat got put on the folks down there in Orange County, and there has been a negotiated settlement between Orange County supervisors and the courts. And with us right now to talk about the cleanup that's now taking place is our very own James Rojas, who is there. Good morning, James. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Doug. The operation yesterday morning got off to a somewhat bumpy start. It began around 8 o'clock in the morning with U.S. District Judge David Carter announcing the lifting of that temporary restraining order that he put into effect And yesterday we saw hundreds of people lining up or trying to line up to get these 30-day motel vouchers. And as you know, the riverbed stretches for miles. So officials had some confusion, had some obstacles organizing everybody and getting them in line. The main spot was right across from the Honda Center. And I was talking to people who said they kept getting pointed in different directions, being given wrong instructions. And I believe we have some sound of some of them.
Yeah, here it is.
When they move this over there later on today, we got to stand back in line and sign up again.
So how long have you guys been waiting?
It's days now.
Days.
Days.
I've been waiting days. There's a lot of people here right now that aren't from the riverbed, who are not a priority, who aren't being removed from their spot. I mean, hopefully they're going to weed them out, but, like, this is insane. Like, this is crazy.
We're more homeless than they are.
Well, it's gay. We're getting evicted from our squatting location, and you got all these people who are squatting somewhere else coming in to get the hotel vouchers. That's essentially what the complaint is, right?
Yeah, and according to the U.S. District Judge, these vouchers, this whole operation, is specifically for those living on the riverbed. But again, as you heard, you had people complaining of outsiders coming there to pick up these motel vouchers and other resources. But we're told that there is this vetting process that those who are not known to be living on the riverbed, that they'll be instead directed to county services. Yeah, we're told that. You know, CityNet, the nonprofit that works with Orange County, they've been out here for nearly a year, 7 days a week. So they've become familiar with the majority of homeless people, and they've been taking names. And so that's what they've been doing to try to catch those that are trying to take advantage of this.
I mean, how do you vet? How do you know if somebody was living there or not? I mean, it's not like they have addresses.
Yeah, there are definitely going to be people that slip through the cracks and do take advantage of this. That is counter to what the judge really wants. Of course, he wants the priority of the riverbed, those living there, out first. And it is kind of amazing with the little progress that has been made so far, because looking at the area, the riverbed that's on the side of Anaheim right by Angel Stadium, that's been cleared out. So it's amazing to see what a couple of months difference makes from what looked like, as you mentioned, like Blade Runner 2049, and now it looks like a normal trail that it's supposed to be.
Jim, what, you know, when we talk about they're handing out 30-day motel vouchers, what motel are taking in the homeless? I mean, what business model is that?
Yeah, this is one that many people have been raising questions of how sustainable it is. And not only are some homeless people kind of wary of doing that, you also have homeless advocates who have raised questions of how sanitary these motels are, even because they've heard reports that many of these motels, they're not up to safety standards. There's bed bugs. There are rats. And so you also have people saying this isn't enough.
If there isn't now, there will be. I mean, they're going to put up
on. They were living in grass.
They're living
on the riverbed.
In the riverbed. I mean, there's going to have to put a sign. We'll leave the lice on for you. I mean, this is going to be. I can't imagine who's some family coming to Disneyland. And they've booked a room for a couple of days in a motel, and they're in a motel surrounded by people who are living in the street the day before.
And think about this, you know, people are getting these 30-day motel vouchers. If you're in a residence for 30 days, are you entitled to California squatter's rights after that? And they have to take 6 months to kick you out after that?
Who knows? It's such a complex issue. Anyway, the worst stretch right by the Anaheim Stadium apparently has been evacuated. When do they think that the entire riverbed will be emptied out?
So right now they are not focusing this week on physically removing people. Instead, they are trying to do this slow push out. So overnight, no one was arrested. No one was taken into custody because, once again, those anti-camping laws are now enforceable. But this week we're not going to be seeing that. We're going to be seeing more vouchers being passed out. We know that at least or around 230 people have already been placed in motels, and they had 400 vouchers to begin with. And so they will be out there for the rest of the week giving out as many as they can until the motel rooms, as you mentioned, get full, and then they'll have to start using city or county-owned lots and start setting up tents.
All right, Jim, thanks so much. Appreciate you being with us. At James Rojas on Twitter, at James Rojas, KABC is the Twitter handle. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.